These are the Target Files, taking a 21st century look back at the 20th century adventures of the Doctor in novelization and audiobook form, looking through the eyes of adulthood at our childhood memories. After all, a great Time Lord once said, there's no point in being grown up if you can't be childish some of the time. A 20th anniversary special featuring the Doctor in all of his 5 regenerations. Why are all 5 Doctors being removed from their separate time streams? Who is the enemy they will have to unite against? What will become of the Doctors when the battle is over? We have travelled a long way with Doctor Who. The 5 Doctors gives us a chance to turn the clock back and meet some old friends and some old enemies.
Hello there, this is episode 53 of the Target Files podcast, and we're going to discuss the 5 Doctors, written by Terence Dix, with the new audiobook just released with John Coleshaw and Nicholas Briggs as all the other voices.
Yes, hello, this is Mike in Swansea.
And hello, this is Alex in Exeter.
So Al, initial thoughts on the 5 Doctors. I've got a little... A few words to say about my history of loving this story ever since I first saw it 6 years old in 1983 on broadcast. Your initial thoughts on how you first came to this story?
Well, I think like you, I saw it quite didn't see it then, I was still quite young then, but I saw it fairly about 10 years ago, I think. I saw it, and it's just a really good, well, it's really good stories. It has all the bits you really want in a Doctor Who story, really, put into sort of desolate landscape, and sort of has all the familiar companions and Doctors. Even though, you know, it's a bit, you know, we had a bit of things with Tom Baker not really wanting to be there, but it still really works, I think.
The first Target book I ever remember owning, had a look for it in the attic. It's not there. I know we usually talk about covers later on in the podcast, but it's such a iconic, significant one for me that I want to speak about it first of all. Actually, a bit of controversy about this one in the UK, because it appeared in certain supermarkets, before it was actually broadcast on telly, so people got to know the whole plot before the 20th anniversary on the 23rd of November that year.
Oh, really? So that's what we get that still to this day, don't we? With things coming out before they should do. So that's been quite fun. Yeah, I think it's a really beautiful cover. I think you can describe it better than I can, but it's a really standout cover. And I think, you know, this idea of having, you know, all the Doctors helping each other out really works. And I know people aren't fond of sort of multi-Doctor episodes, but I really like them.
Yes, talking about that wonderful cover, Al... A first edition, darkish background, but I'm going to talk a bit about the paperback, which I do still own somewhere in the house. Lovely red Doctor Who Davison era cover. It's an Andrew Skilleter one. The 5 Doctors in red, Terence Dix. There's a square on the front of the the book itself, a square sort of pivoted with a blue rectangle within, and the profile in dark and dark blue of the five Doctor's faces who all appear in this story, and the outer shell of the square has one corner of the TARDIS, one corner of K-9, one corner of the Cybermen, and one of Daleks. Now, that appeared the same in the hardback edition, first of all, Andrew Skillitar, but it actually had the, darker background, which these two shapes were placed against, but the iconic one I remember is the paperback edition, which had the grey background, and it had this sort of wonderful hologram effect, I remember, of looking at all the Doctors.
Oh, it sort of came at you.
Yes, looking at all the Doctors in profile, so being totally biased, you know, at that age, probably my favourite Target cover ever, I think.
I think it has been one of the best ones. It just has everything on it you want. It has the Doctors, it has the monsters, and that sort of putting them in each square, I think, really works well. I always liked it as well.
I felt the novelisation, because I've seen the TV version so many times, I deliberately stayed away from it when undertaking this research for the review, Alan, just focused on the audiobook and novelisation, the new audiobook by John Culshaw.
That's interesting, because I did the same.
Okay, yeah, what were your reasons for that, Al?
I just think it was like I didn't want to, because there's so much going on, and you have these conflicts with Tom Baker and other characters, but I didn't want to. Though it's brilliant, I didn't really want to watch it. I just wanted to listen to the audiobook and see how that worked.
Yeah, Al, I'm just going to put you up a notch, okay? Can you speak again for a minute, mate? Yeah, we're more or less a little bit more level now.
That's better. How's that?
Yeah, it's a similar reason to me, Al. I've got so many of these scenes played out in my head because I've seen it so many times. Such a strong memory of them. I wanted to see what Terence really had added in terms of the thought processes of characters, and he has some nice little touches in that way.
Oh, definitely. He's definitely added some nice extra details, and it's sort of very, very laid out well. And I think, you know, everybody gets their own sort of area, I think.
Yeah, is it possibly a little bit too crowded when you consider, I think it's five Doctors. Tom has some footage used over from Sharda, Tom Baker, who didn't want to appear at this period in his life. Such was his probable at the time proprietary feeling about the role of the Doctor. And we have 10 companions altogether. Do you feel it's well spread out, and the fact it's just a big sort of party for the 20th anniversary allows them to place in all these former characters?
I think it works better with some than others. I agree that they all should be there because, you know, it adds a bit of fun for the anniversary. But I think, you know, some get more space to breathe, like, you know, having Sarah Jane with the third Doctor works, and putting Tegan with the first Doctor really works. And I think some get less than others, I think.
Yes, and we get that wonderful little addition by Terence Dix of Susan being abducted from 21st century Earth after the Dalek invasion, where she stays behind with David, and the wonderful William Hartnell speech, which we get in the TV version, which is repeated.
Yeah, definitely. That really is really nice time, because Big Finish have used that a lot. The whole backstory of Susan's been well looked into now, but I think that's a nice sort of extra there, really.
Yes, Al, we're going to sort of to and fro as we do in our most recent podcasts. John Culshaw's performance. I want to say quite a bit about this, to be honest. He is a superb impressionist. He's obviously done David Tennant and Tom Baker very well in Dead Ringers in the past. I thought he to and fro'd a bit with some of the Doctors and some of the other characters in this book, to be totally honest.
I was feeling the same. I thought some he got really, really well, and some weren't that great, to be honest. I thought the normal two, Tom Baker was brilliant, and I thought his John Pertwee was really good. Well, I thought his Peter Davison was a bit awful, to be honest.
Yeah, so wasn't that sort of breathiness that I know John has done before on an episode of Doctor Who Confidential about a decade ago called Do You Remember the First Time, where David Tennant interviewed him and Nev Fountain, the comedy writer, and he sort of gave a little teaser impression of most of the incarnations that he does here, but they seem so vastly different from the ones he did in that Confidential episode 10 years ago.
I was just thinking that the only two what I thought were really close were the Pertwee and the Tom Baker. I wasn't a big fan of the Peter Davison, and I thought the Wooden Hartnell was sort of a bit hit and miss.
I think it's... The First Doctor one is fine because it is Richard Hurndal. It's whether you feel it needed to be more like Hartnell, as this is the chance within an audiobook, but it is definitely reminiscent of Richard Hurndal, I found. And,
I would agree with that. I agree. Well, I was just sort of semi-listening to it as sort of William Hartnell. It wasn't getting close. And then there was bits with the Brigadier's voice where, you know, sometimes he had it spot on and then sometimes it wasn't that great.
Yeah, in certain sections, I think towards the end, he started to improve as a Brigadier. And for me, he started off a little bit strangely with his performance of Pertwee, but... He did improve as things went on, but the one that really got to me, and I've made a note of it here, was Anthony Ainley's Master. Now, at certain points, he sounded very disinterested. I know Anthony Ainley plays it quite sheepishly in the TV version, as he doesn't want to let the Doctor or the other Gallifreyan hierarchy know that he'll probably end up double-crossing them at the end. But I've put the note down that he reminded me at times of Michael Horden as Paddington back in the day. You know, he seemed that sort of laid-back, disinterested feel for the Master character.
Needs that sort of menace, and it sort of didn't have it, unfortunately. It's sort of nothing really there to make you feel he was a bit creepy. He's sort of, you know, I'm there, I'm being malevolent, but I'm not giving it all, really.
Yeah, because if you remember lately... We have done Castrovalva, and I thought Peter Davison had Anthony Ainley down to an absolute T then, so I thought we might have had a similar approach from John Coleshaw, but not to be in this one.
No, I would agree. Peter Davison in Castrovalva was really menacing as the Anthony Ainley Master, where here it's a bit, you know... And I thought, the other thing I thought was really bad, what I picked up immediately, was his Tegan impression is terrible.
Yeah, and I thought Tulu was okay because I suppose Mark Strickson doesn't get a lot of dialogue in the TV version anyway, does he?
No, not really. You know, he's sort of there as an extra. Tegan gets loads. And I thought his Susan was okay, but it wasn't the greatest.
Yeah, we seem to have found a lot of faults in his work, but one I'm going to say was absolutely superb was Barossa. He really gave him the gravitas, I felt.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think, you know, there are... things to listen to in this, because it's a really good... I listened to it in one session because it's that good. But I think, like, you know, Niggles, Barossa's really good, and I really liked his... I think once he got going, his John Pertwee was spot on. There was real sort of old, you know, sort of depth and humour with him and Sarah Jane. It does work, but it just takes a while, I think.
Yeah, I don't know if it's because he's a comedy performer, but also his Troughton at times reminded me of the actor Derek Nimmo.
Oh, yeah.
In the UK, folks, used to be a comedy performer, actor who played a lot of sort of religious roles, didn't he, as the comedy vicar?
Yeah, he's sort of comedy vicar and did another very famous panel show in England called Just a Minute, where you have to speak on a topic for a minute, and he was very famous. So I see exactly where you're coming now thinking about that. He was very Derek Nimmo.
Yeah, Just a Minute, still going, of course, and David Tennant was on that in the last few years, wasn't he? And he successfully spoke quite a few times without hesitation.
Yeah, he was very good on it. You can probably track that down on YouTube, and it's very good, David Tennant. Hopefully he'll do more. But it's like, I see exactly where you're coming. These were occasionally parodies of other people. And, you know, though he's very good, it didn't work in some places.
No, and on the other side of that, I thought Nick Briggs' Cyberman voice was absolutely outstanding in this.
Oh, the Nick Briggs bits are fantastic with him as Cyberman and Daleks. They're really great.
Yeah, he's really got that menace, isn't he? You know, when the menace and the sort of, I wouldn't say emotionless concern when the Master has that moment where they're crossing the chessboard.
Oh, no, that bit is great. When they're crossing the chessboard and, you know, he bamboozles the Cybermen into killing himself, basically, is brilliant.
And one utterly sensational, if it's sound design, or I do wonder if it was actually lifted from the TV version, was the voice of Rassilon himself at the end, because it did sound to me identical.
I'm not too sure. I would agree that was identical. I think it might have been lifted.
Yes, but, you know, we have had these... great pieces of audio manufacturing before me, audio generation, like Galaxy 4, wasn't it, where we had Maureen O'Brien doing the male voice, which was absolutely spot on and had been treated in some way.
It'd be interesting to know, because, you know, we have missed these things before.
Yes, any interesting scenes that's stuck out for you in this Five Doctors, Al?
There's a few bits. So it's like, as we said already, said the chess scene board where the Cybermen come in and get basically blown up is great fun. And I like the bit with where William Hartnell's Doctor and Susan outwit the Dalek by making it blow itself up. Were really good fun. And with the whole thing with a multi-universe Doctors, it can get a bit confusing. Well, I think this one does keep you going because of being set in one place is a good idea, I think.
Yes, it does flow nicely, the pace, both in the novel and the audiobook and in the TV version.
Yeah, I just think it would have been nice if they'd used the actual great music score for this Five Doctors, because there's some beautiful bits of music.
Yeah, but I thought the soundscape and the effects were pretty well used. They weren't overused, as possibly has been the case in some of our most recent reviews.
Oh, definitely. It was a nice balance. I just love that. Is it when you first get into the Death Zone, there's that beautiful piece of that horn that goes off?
Yes. I've added that one on the beginning of this podcast
as well. I love that piece of music. It's so sort of, this is the Death Zone we're in. It's beautiful.
Yes, I added the version that Peter Howell came back for, and Mark Ayres joined him for the 50th anniversary prom back in 2013.
All good, because that's really nice, that is. I've got that, that's really nice.
Yes, talking about the Doctors again being scooped out of time, I remember reading a fan theory either in a magazine or online a few years ago that the first Doctor is scooped from a rose garden.
Oh, yeah.
And he's also scooped from a rose garden as the Gallifreyans see him on screen in The Three Doctors, the 10th anniversary special. And people were just sort of speculating if that both happened on the same day, how peed off he'd be.
This is a weird one for time wobbly woobly, isn't it? It's sort of, perhaps it did all happen on the same day.
And I suppose we do know that it didn't happen a third time coming up to Christmas, as it's going to be straight from the 10th planet by the look of it. So
I think that's straight from 10th planet. Once upon a time is going to be straight where, you know, that's how it ended the end of the season, did it?
Maybe that's why he looks so grumpy, Hartnell. You know, they took him away from his roses.
Maybe he might have been in his garden and scooped up. Yeah, I think the
stop bothering me.
Different way.
Yeah, talk about that again. Of course, we have Tom in Sharda. On luckily enough, they had the extra footage, didn't they? Because I can't imagine what it would have been like without any footage of him.
What do you think you could really have got away with having no footage of Tom? Because, you know, even with the 50th anniversary, that one bit was the thing, everybody's favourite. That way you saw him as the caretaker. That one bit. So I really don't think, back in the heyday, you could have got rid of, you couldn't have the episode without Tom.
He was so proprietorial about the role then, wasn't he? Either wanting to, it was a combination of the wanting to distance himself after only leaving the role in 1981 after 7 years, and this occurring late in 1983.
Yeah, so there wasn't much time, and it took nearly 20 years, I think, for Big Finish to get him to do anything for them. So it's always a thing with Tom. It's sort of very, you know, gentle approach from, I think.
Yes, we get the lovely scene of Troughton's Doctor, of course, going back to visit the Brigadier.
Oh yeah, that's really nice, that the first bit of the Brigadier, and, you know, it's the Doctor, and it's the first one he met.
Yes, and what I thought was the funniest line ever written in anything at the age of six, when John Pertwee is driving Bessie and he spots the scoop triangle and says, "Great balls of fire!"
It's just hilarious.
That was often quoted as a child with a naughty grin on my face around the house. So.
I bet.
Red balls of fire. Ah. Yes, and of course we get Davison's Doctor and the TARDIS team at the time. Tegan and Turlough, how do you feel they came across? They don't get a heck of a lot to do they?
I think, you know, it's a normal problem by now. Davison's team were like, why are we all here still? It's like, the only one who really gets a lot to do is Tegan, really, and Turlough sort of hang on a bit, really.
Yes, because the First Doctor and Susan arrived. Herndl, the First Doctor, more or less tells Tegan to go and make some tea, which doesn't go down well.
I think even if you told her these days, that wouldn't go down well. It's like
interesting, because I know that David Bradley at a recent Comic Con with Pearl Mackey was asked about this. There's rumoured to be a line in the Christmas special upcoming where It's going to be a spoiler, folks, so give it 10-20 seconds until I tell Alex this. There's rumoured to be a line, I think, which Bradley might have confirmed, where the Doctor, we've seen from the trailer that he meets Bill again, and they're in Capaldi's TARDIS console room, and he turns around to Bill, apparently, and says, "This place is a looks a bit dusty. Don't you keep it clean for him?" So, and apparently Capaldi is the one in the special who says, "No, no, we can't say that anymore." You know, so Moffat is going to address how attitudes have changed in that time. But, you know, I never saw back in the day, really, somebody like Barbara Wright, the first companion of the first Doctor, as somebody who would be in that sort of role.
No, I don't think so either. She was quite, for the time period, you know, feminist outlook, she was quite... You know, I'm not going to make tea, and it's the same with Tegan. I think that whole way that they sort of spark off each other and get on quite well in the end, her and the First Doctor. So I think, you know, there's genuine bits of make use of Janet Fielding because she is very good in it, even though she's got the worst shoes possible on.
Yes, and that famous ankle damaging scene.
Well, I'm not surprised in sort of trying to go across. Well, I'm not too sure where that terrain was, but it's like. Don't wear high heels. It's a nightmare.
It's actually sort of mid Wales, Al. I'm not far from about 2 or 3 years ago now. I went to a screening of this story with a chat with Terence Dix afterwards in Aberystwyth University.
Oh, is he near there?
They were literally saying it's about 45 minutes or so up the road from there in the freezing cold North Wales winter. Back once more to the area where they filmed the Abominable Snowman in the 60s.
Not surprised.
But what does make me laugh in the book, compared to the TV version, is Sarah Jane apparently falling off the edge of a cliff, which is just a bank, really, in the TV version.
That's not good.
And, of course, two hugely remembered scenes for a lot of fans. The Raston Warrior robot. How do you feel that came across in the audiobook and the novelisation? I thought there was an interesting sound, sort of springy sound effect behind it, which sort of did work, but perhaps went on for a little bit too long.
Yeah, there was some sort of weird bongy noise, wasn't there, on the audiobook, which is quite fun, but sort of took out the sort of menace and tension of him a bit, I thought. But the sort of tension's there in the reading, I think, you know, how, you know, it follows every movement, so there's no way of getting round it, really. I think it does work, but I agree, the sound effect was quite funny.
I think what it reminded me of, Al, was the boinging noise always reminds me of a slinky toy going downstairs.
Yeah, it's sort of that, and a bit of separatism from the magic roundabout it was minding me off.
Yes, and by the time it got to the end of this section of the audiobook, I was expecting Jim Carrey's voice to come in and scream like he does in the second Ace Ventura film, where the slinky stops with one step to go from the Tibetan monastery.
That's fun, though. I sort of started humming the magic roundabout when I got to the end of that bit.
Yes, and of course Ace Ventura, our second film, features a certain Ian McNeice, Winston Churchill in Doctor Who, and for Big Finish now as well.
Definitely. It's a nice little reference there. It's sort of... I think the tension goes out of the robot a little bit in the book, but I think there's still menace there with Sarah adds menace to it. You know, so you feel... something's going to happen to her, I think.
I've often wondered just how it works so well, the Raston Warrior robot, because it's pretty obvious as you grow up that it's a guy in a silver outfit. But I think it's the movement of a guy. Is it Adrian somebody? Is it Adrian Wrigglesford or somebody?
You look at it and you think that's just a guy in a silver suit. Well, then you look at it again and you think that's quite scary.
But it's just like the flick of the palms of the wrists, isn't it? And the weapons coming out, the projectiles coming out. Bullets.
You think Sarah and the Third Doctor are going to get killed in about a second. So I think it does work. For some weird reason, it works.
Have you ever seen, Al, the fan-made video from the 90s, the edit? It's called The Five Doctors or something, and it features a mashup of that scene with the giant were-rabbit from Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
I think at one point in one of the regens they had it on, and it's hilarious.
Oh, it's fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the other sort of major scene I was thinking of, Al, we've referred to it slightly earlier on, is the scene across the chessboard with the Master. He's very much up to his deviousness by that point.
Yeah, that's a really clever scene where, you know, you've got this sort of chessboard and it's all fine till you get to level 5 on the chessboard, and then suddenly you get blown to bits, unless you know the method of pi, apparently, or some clever mathematical thing. And the Master sort of being very sly and confident talks the Cybermen into blowing themselves up. So I think it's a really great scene full of sort of comedy and a bit of tension, really.
And it's very strange because he takes this almost sort of moral stance, doesn't he? Because I think it's Tegan who witnesses this and says, you know, that was very devious, that was horrible of you. And he says, well, didn't your pathetic species used to guide sheep across minefields, you know, to...
Yeah, there's that great, there is that great line about the sheep and minefield, how we used to do that. And it's like, you know, you're basically trying to say I'm wrong when you've been doing it for years.
Yeah, one of those lines that's always stuck out, really.
Yeah, it's a great line. It's a great line. And, you know, Anthony does it brilliant. I just think, how, you know, those Cybermen are so stupid how they're trusting him or, you know, in under a second.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And on towards the ending in Rassilon's Tumel, we have the various phantoms that appear to the third and the second doctors. I understand they can only get Fraser Hines out of his Emmerdale contract for one day's filming, and he was planned to have a much bigger role.
Yeah, that's the story we've heard from Fraser, that, you know, he was stuck in Emmerdale, unfortunately, and couldn't get it because he wanted to be there for lots more. And I think those sort of sequences there work really well in the book, and they come across not bad in the DVD as well. I think, you know, that whole bringing sort of unit people back as well. And I think there's a really nice feel to it.
It's nice to see them, isn't it? It's a nice sort of throwback.
It's that great thing I think you get of all, you know, the big reunion episodes where you think, oh, it's great, he's there, and it's sort of, you're quite happy, I think.
Didn't go down this route of lots of companions for the 50th anniversary Day of the Doctor?
Yeah, I think, you know, Day of the Doctor works because it is, I think, except for the last sort of 20 minutes, it is quite minimal with just, you know, the David Tennant and Matt Smith and their characters. But I think it does work.
Yes, you know, a different era of TV now, isn't it? You know, possibly a question I brought up before, Al, when we've done multi-Doctor stories. Do you feel a lot of fans have said it's prevalent more in the classic series multi-Doctor stories than it was in the 50th anniversary? Are the actors playing parodies? The returning actors, are they playing parodies of their incarnations?
I think there is a smidgen of that, and I think that's why the great, if you haven't seen it, people, the great comedy thing of Peter Davison did, which is hilarious, and that sort of was playing parodies of all their different doctors. But I think in this, it sort of, you know, you probably are playing a parody because it works, and, you know, as we all know, we only got a multi-doctor story because Stephen Moffat couldn't think of anything else to write.
Would you say it's a darker theme to Doctor Who nowadays? Because I'm going to use the issue of Rassilon to try and make this point, Al. Rassilon in this story is quite a jolly guy, considering he's immortal, isn't he? A big, jolly, fat guy. But we obviously know there's been a time war since this period, in whatever time, whatever way time occurs or appears on Gallifrey. He's brought back as a bit of a psychopath, Timothy Dalton-wise. So that sort of made the World of Who a little bit more serious, would you say, in the darker stories than it was in the classic series?
I think that, you know, when you get big sort of Time Lord villains in the, you know, the classic series, like Omega and Rassilon, they're always a bit more pantomime-y. Well, you know, when you got to the Russell T. Davis period, he stripped all that back and made it an awful lot darker with people like, you know, the Master and Rassilon. When you saw them, they were, you know, psychopaths because they've been for a war, basically, and we know how war affects people. So I'd say definitely they're a lot darker in the Russell T. Davis period than they are to, like, the classic season.
If you could change anything about this story, what would you change?
Don't think there's a lot to change. Maybe because, like you, I'd like a bit more Tom, basically. If I could, you know, go back, I'd persuade Tom to be in it a bit more, maybe. And I don't think there's any... So I'm trying to remember. Is there any... There's not really any of his companions, and I'd like maybe Leela to be there, basically.
Yeah, it's interesting to think, you know, it's pretty perfect to me as it is, because I've just got such a great, strong childhood memory of it. But it's more of a fascination to wonder what Tom would have brought to it. You know, would he have gone for it and tried to steal the show up against the older hands of Troughton and Pertwee in particular?
I think it would have been an ego clash, maybe, but I think there would have been more scenes with Pat and Tom. That they would have been great. You know, the things we've had recently where we've had, you know, Tom with other doctors, and it just works so well.
This is Alex Gibbon's Doctor Who News Round.
Hello there, this is the Who's News on the 13th of November. And first thing to mention is that we are going to get some new Target books. Now, these are going to be Target imaginations of new Who episodes. So we're going to get Rose, we're going to get The Christmas Invasion, Twice Upon a Time, and they're going to also reprint a reprint of City of Death. These are going to be written by Russell T. Davis for Rose and Stephen Moffat for Twice Upon a Time, Day of the Doctor. Jenny Colgan and James Goss for the reprint of City of Death, published by Penguin Australia Books, apparently. And unfortunately, there are no audiobook releases yet, but we can hope and expect they will be. Well, this week, of course, is Children in Need Week, which you can give donations at www.bbc.co.uk/children-in-need. And the great thing is that they're going to show at least 3 minutes of the Christmas episode of Doctor Who. It should be on about after 7:30, but just keep watching because it will appear eventually. There are some lovely photos out there of Pearl Mackey with Pugsy the Bear. From bigfinish.com, we have to mention that it's now going to be now 40 years since Blake 7 started, and Big Finish are preparing to do a lot of events for that next year with a box set called The Way Ahead. It's going to be 3 different time periods of Blake 7 and will, of course, involve Jacqueline Pierce as Servalan. The 1987 Star Cops is coming back through Big Finish. It's going to be released as 2 special box sets next year and has a superb cast involving Rakeem Fakwa and also lots of other great actors. If you enjoyed it originally, I would well recommend Big Finish's new launch. We need us, of course, look at the end scores for this great 5 Doctors. What are yours, Mike?
Going to be totally biased, Al. It's a 10 for me. Just because it's so wrapped up with my childhood. I think deliberately not watching the TV version again helped. Can't ever find a lot of fault with it. Just a good fun, a good bit of pantomime, but it's a celebration. That's what you do at parties. You go all out. And this audiobook version is superb. Some issue with some of John Coltrane's voices, but he keeps the pace going very well. Expresses the right words at the right times. Terence Woods, it's a bit of a A to B copy of the TV script, but he has added a few moments. That wonderful, wonderful, I'm going to keep saying it, wonderful cover, Andrew Skylleter. 10 out of 10.
I think I would have to agree with you, because I was going to give it a little bit lower because of the few niggles I had with John Coltrane, but I can honestly live with those, because it is such a great book, and it's sort of great pace, and it's got all those lovely old characters working so well. Those bits with Sarah Jane and John Pertwee's Third Doctor are really great fun, and you know it's just real fun, so I'm going to give it a 10 as well, I think.
Absolutely wonderful, Al. Quite a lot of news this week, Al. We had a big reveal on Thursday. The costume for the 13th Doctor, played by Jodie Whittaker. What did you think?
Well, it's a real interesting one, because I know it's a very Marmite costume. Some people love it and some people hate it. Well, I think it sort of covers all bases of, you know, somebody who's not too sure about the, you know, being in a female body for the first time and having all those sort of elements of, you know, dress, sort of still trying to have a sort of masculine dress, but they're just having those little flourishes with the earrings, I think really works. I think it's quite fun, really.
Yes, very good. Not overly sexualized, I think, is the word, you know, just sort of comfortable wear. Should be a fairly easy one for people to cosplay.
Yeah, I think it's a very easy one to cosplay, and it's just the fact it's, you know, she's bound to have different size jackets for different bits, but I think it works really well. It's a nice, simple costume that has, you know, references back to the other Doctors, you know, with the braces and the trousers and all that sort of stuff. But I think it works really well. It's not too over the top. I know people aren't too keen on the colour palette, you know, of yellow braces and the rainbow bits on the jacket, but otherwise I think it's quite fun.
And a bit of a bling earring there, of course. I'm a bit worried in case she snags it on a Dalek stalk or something.
Yeah, they were saying something like that. That's why I think it's going to be different jackets for the running and that if she does have to run.
And a spoiler, folks, you know, give it 10, 20 seconds again, but there was a professional photographer did catch Jodie Whittaker and Sharon D. Brewster. Jodie wearing an overcoat over Peter Capaldi's outfit, so we should get through the traditional start to the new Doctor wearing the former Doctor's outfit, which is always an exciting moment.
Oh, most definitely. I think, you know, it's the joys of filming anything in Wales at 3 a.m. That's why there's lots of overcoats, I think. It's a nice, clever trick of keeping warm.
Yeah, a bit of controversy really over the weekend. Well, for a good few months now, I'll admit I don't know all the facts myself, but there seems to have been a bit of a split lately in the set reporting of Doctor Who filming. You know, it's got very nasty between groups of people. There was a rumour that certain people had been given information about Peter Capaldi's last day when they could go and wait outside the studio for him, and that it was suggested, not definitely true, folks, that certain people had mentioned a different day to other regular set reporters, so they would literally have Peter all to themselves, and there was a great deal of upset about that. There's been a bit of concern in the later Capaldi era about people turning up to a lot of the filming, you know, getting a lot of pictures. There's the element of stalking there, which people are a little bit worried about. So probably a lot of good reasons now for Chris Chibnall to be secretive. But, you know, I'm looking forward to it if I don't get spoiled, as I have gone looking for in the last sort of 10 years of series.
As you were saying, that whole, because there was a Twitter feed, wasn't it? In about 2 minutes, it vanished for the first Jodie Whittaker shoot, obviously, and that sort of got taken down pretty quickly by the looks of it.
Yes, and we had Bradley Walsh interviewed on various shows in the UK over the weekend, and he was being very humorous, very sarcastic, talking about all the airport scanners that he had to go through with his ID, and how every script has people's names printed on it, and, you know, there's deliberate mistakes on certain copies of the script so they can be leaked back to the people who might leak them.
Well, I can see why they do, because they're just people there who will pick up anything related to Doctor Who and then bung it on eBay for ridiculous prices. You know, it's just what happens, unfortunately, these days.
And, well, we do know, I think we did get a story at Regen from Sylvester McCoy that he'd shown a script of the Hobbit page to one of his friends and said, I'm going to let you read that for 15 seconds because you won't be able to retain it. And Sylvester actually said, you know, this page of the script has my name on it, so if anything's leaked, it'll go straight back to me.
Exactly. And those sort of things work a bit, I think, but it's just like, you know, I'm not surprised that things are getting a bit ridiculous because it's sort of a major thing, isn't it, Doctor Who?
But got to say, folks, some of the reactions online to Chibnall's Great Security were absolutely screaming entitlement, and they were absolutely appalling. You know, some quotes such as one more or less off the top of my head, I'm just paraphrasing here, was Chris Chibnall should realise we've put him where he is. You know, he owes this to the fans. That is absolutely ridiculous. You know, he doesn't. You know, he's an experienced writer from Broadchurch back in the day.
He's done what people like Danny Boyle you know, what you had to do back in the day. He has cut his teeth on lots of different TV jobs and has worked his way up, basically.
Yeah, we are owed nothing in the UK apart from our licence fees, which pays for Doctor Who, you know, but I don't expect to be able to go to the set. I have been to a set with Peter Capaldi and the lovely Jenna 3 years ago for The Robot of Sherwood out on the Powys countryside here in Wales, and met them both. It was a lovely, lovely day. They were both brilliant ambassadors for the show. But, you know, I don't think we were at all intrusive that day. We weren't certainly not as nasty and backstabbing as social media has got with this sort of situation now.
It's just gone out of control, I personally think. It's like, you know, if you're there to meet, you know, like your fan or friends, then just, you know, be nice. Don't hassle them. Don't go up to them and go, oh, what an autograph now? You know, don't be like that. You know, they're giving up their time to be nice to you, really, to be bluntly honest.
And it's a job, you know. They do have great time pressures on this show, on a lot of television.
I know, you look at, you know, in the Peter Capaldi era, there was times when he was doing filming on Paddington, then coming back to film this, then probably doing interviews everywhere, and it's just all those extra bits just don't help them.
I know, I mean, Matt Lucas told us how demanding Peter's schedule was, and we've been told at Regen by various people how demanding Matt Smith's, David Tennant's schedule and Chris Eccleston's were.
Well, I'm not surprised, because they do so much other stuff, voice stuff and editing stuff. It's a sort of, it all mounts up.
But I'm just talking about the Doctor Who role here, Al. You know, we know that Peter, that David, that Chris, all the new series Doctors, Matt, you know, they might be filming a scene for one moment. They're rushed off to do an interview with Doctor Who magazine or a TV station from around the world. They're rushed back in for their next scene. You know, it's constantly like that for them, I think, for the whole nine months of the shoot.
9 months of the shoot is not their life. It's like every 2 minutes they're doing so. And then do, you know, incorporate the fans as well, which they do brilliantly. You know, you should be appreciative of that. You shouldn't think it's a God-given right that you should be, you know, given an autograph after the actor of Doctor Who. They do that because they know that they, you know, that the fans enjoy it. You know, they enjoy meeting us, basically.
Well said, mate. Well said. And on to some more news. New Target novels, Al. Something I am hugely excited about, but I do hope we get audio releases eventually.
I think it's a great idea that these Target books are coming out, because it's so great, you know, having maybe more in-depth backstory, you know, like the first meeting of Rose and the Doctor. Maybe, you know, because I know Russell will probably flesh them out. It's like, it'll be great. And all those little back bits that you used to get in Target books, I reckon you'll get for the new episodes.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting. People more or less probably will read them just for those extra flourishes, won't they? You know, and having the fact that Stephen and Russell in particular, we also have Jenny Colgan writing one, we have James Goss writing The City of Death. They all grew up with Target books. They're going to know the structure of these books inside out, and they're going to be able to give them the modern twists as well.
I know, it's going to be great, because Russell obviously did New Adventures, and I think Stephen Moffat's book is going to be great as well. I think you get all that lovely backstory sort of come about in other ways with Rose and Jackie and the whole sort of estate and all that. I think it's just going to be a lot more in depth, is what you want, really, because you just don't have that time in 45 minutes to put all that into an episode. And I think, knowing Russell, there's probably lots that's going to go into his book, I reckon.
Budget wise, Al, if you could buy only one of the four, I think they're all due to be out on the same day, the 3rd of March 2018, which one would you choose?
Well, it's a tough one, because I think out of the four, if I can only buy one, I don't know, because it's sort of probably go with the regen one, which is Christmas Invasion.
Yeah, or to, for me, you know, Twice Upon a Time is coming as well. Possibly because we haven't seen it yet. You know, it might change after I've seen it, but all Day of the Doctor for me, because it's just going to be so reminiscent of what Stephen can do in terms of what we've just discussed with the Five Doctors.
Yeah, that's going to be a good one, because you've got to, you know, get all the stuff for the anniversary. And I think because you're going to get a regen again, it probably will be Christmas Invasion with me. So, we must get on to our fun recommendations in TV, books, film. What have you been watching, Mike?
I've gone back and started to watch. The new series has been on Channel 4, Series 4, over the last few weeks. Man Down, the comedy series starring Greg Davis, who appeared as Hydro Flax in the Christmas special, The Husbands of Riversong, I think it was called, 2 years ago.
Yeah, it was. He's just hilarious, Greg Davis is.
Oh, yeah, and you get the brilliant first series where, tragically, he's passed away now. Rick Mayall played his dad, who was absolutely bonkers.
I didn't know Rick Mayall was in that as well.
Yeah, in the first series, he played his dad, who's also always playing sort of strange practical jokes on his son, and it's absolutely fantastic. And I think Greg Davis was interviewed round about the time Rick Mayall had a tribute show on the Christmas after he died. And, you know, he said, obviously, there's a bit of a facial resemblance between Rick Mayall and Greg Davis. Yeah, and he was almost in tears, Greg, you know, saying that he missed the fact that Rick would be there every day giving him a hug on set, you know, one of his childhood heroes, and then working with him.
Oh, that's great, that is.
Yeah, you know, but a fantastic show. You later on in the series, you get a cameo by Mark Hamill.
Of course, yeah, you do, don't you? Yeah.
Mid-season episode of Star Trek Discovery to watch tonight. So I haven't watched it yet.
I think the other main thing I've enjoyed so much, it's so well done, is the A Word.
Oh, Christopher Eccleston again. Yes, I'm not caught up with it yet. Sounds fantastic.
It is a great drama about, I don't know if you haven't seen it, it's basically, it's in season two now, but it's a drama about basically a family who are having to deal with their son having autism, basically, and having to deal with their son and how it affects the family. And it's just fantastic. You know, it's got really good actors, and it's got Christopher Eccleston who plays a sort of granddad who sort of steps up to help the child. And it's just really cleverly written, and it's well worth a watch on the iPlayer if you haven't watched it. It's brilliant.
Yes, I work with people with learning disabilities and development disorders, folks, and I'm finding that TV is capturing these conditions quite brilliantly in the modern era with drama.
It's just really good that they don't give it the sort of, you know, it's not the Rain Man sort of, you know, it's autism. It's sort of, it's just treated as though he's part of the family. He's now seven, the kid Joe, isn't it? And it's sort of dealing with all the sort of issues parents would have to deal with, and it's sort of done so well. It's still got quite a bit of comedy in there, sort of, with Christopher Eccleston's really got quite good comedy in it, but it's just really enjoyable. Which is, you know, it's a bit weird because you think, you know, something about a disability wouldn't be enjoyable, but it's actually the way it's acted and the people in it are great.
Great, Al. And one thing I want to recommend is a podcast called Smursh, looking back at the James Bond films. And occasionally they go back and look at other films as well. And recently they've looked at Theatre of Blood with Vincent Price, a classic horror, and The Wild Geese. And last week they did their latest Bond review of Tomorrow Never Dies. Hilarious podcast. I thoroughly recommend it. Smursh Pod.
I will have to listen to that because that's one of my favourite Pierce Brosnan films, Tomorrow Never Dies. It's got great cast and that.
Yeah, I tend to rewatch the films now when there's a new Smursh Pod coming up, and just you see so much humour in it from the presenters. They have a different sort of presenter on every week with the main man. I think his name's John Rain, but it's thoroughly recommended, Smursh Pod.
Very good. I'm trying to think what I've been listening to. It's mainly I was talking about Big Finish, the great new Torchwood box set, which are fantastic. And I don't think what else. Music-wise, there's all lots of stuff. There's lots of stuff out at the moment, but it's sort of general, I think. Those are the things we can recommend.
Yes, Al, and a bit of a change of direction for our podcast now before Christmas. Listeners might have noticed been running quite a few Twitter polls recently on your favourite and least favourite Stephen Moffat stories. What I think we might be doing, Al, if you'd agree with this, mate, I'm just putting it to you now, is to look at ours and the listeners' top three and bottom three and have a new sort of section to our podcast going off from the main target novels sometimes called Hit and Miss Specials. And we'll start with looking at some of those Stephen Moffat stories from the end of this long era, which is about to be completed.
Oh, definitely, that's got to be done, because, you know, it's very interesting, because I've seen the poll results you've sent me, how ones I think would be really up there have been really low, so we've definitely got to do that.
So we'll be doing that in the run-up to Christmas, folks, but we are getting the 10th Planet novelisation, read by Annika Wills, released in December, and we will probably, I was thinking maybe a double episode, Al, of doing that and the Christmas special, seeing as those two stories are linked.
I think so. I think the audiobook's out on the 7th of December, so definitely we will connect those two, because it's quite, you know, we've got a really big episode coming up with lots of change. And well, next time for the Tiger Files podcast, we will be looking at the Stephen Moffat era, the hits and misses, in our opinion.
You can contact Doctor Who Target Files on Twitter at DW Target Files handle, or search Facebook for the Doctor Who Target Files podcast page and leave us a message. Thanks for listening. Doctor Who Target Files, the Five Doctors Review, featured Alexander Gibbons and Michael Winks. 12th Doctor theme, composed originally by Murray Gold. Version for this podcast by Vale Mystery. That's V-A-Y-L-E Mystery. Please check out that channel name on YouTube. The Five Doctors, incidental music, composed originally by Peter Howell. Newsround, opening and closing themes, composed originally by Ted Heath and his orchestra, and by John Baker. Doctor Who Target Files, The Five Doctors Review, was recorded in Exeter, Devon, England, UK, and Swansea, Wales, UK, during November 2017.